And good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. Thanks for tuning in. 2018 is a big election year in Minnesota, and there's no office bigger than governor. Democrat Mark Dayton is not seeking another term, and candidates from both major political parties have been working for months, raising money, organizing, and asking for support. The first test of that effort comes tomorrow night when people from around the state gather at neighborhood meetings called precinct caucuses. It's the first step in the process of choosing candidates the parties will endorse at their state conventions in June. We invited the DFL candidates for governor, and believe it or not, they all said yes. In fact, so many that we had to move to a bigger studio. Here they are in alphabetical order. Former St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman, State Representative Tina Liebling, State Representative Aaron Murphy, State Auditor Rebecca Otto, State Representative Paul Thiessen, and Congressman Tim Walz. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This isn't really a debate, and I'm not running a stopwatch or anything like that, but with so many people, we do need to keep things moving so everybody has a fair turn. And so I wanted to start by asking if you were riding in an elevator for 30 seconds with a caucus goer, what's your message about why they should support you? Let's start alphabetically with Chris Coleman. 30 seconds. What would you tell me on that elevator?
Well, thanks, Mike. This year's election, the stakes are very, very high. Are we going to elect a progressive champion for Minnesota families, or are we going to elect a person that's beholden to the alt-right that will divide us? The next governor of the state of Minnesota has to be a champion for economic security for our families. They have to be fighting for good jobs and that pay good wages and have good benefits. They have to have a fight for a healthcare system that doesn't bankrupt our families. We have to have an education system that makes sure that every child is prepared to take their place in 21st century workforce. And we have to be a just and equitable community for all.
Okay. I'm sorry. I have to get off here. Thank you. Okay. Tina Liebling, what would you say if I were on an elevator with you for 30 seconds?
I'm Tina Liebling. I'm a state representative from Rochester. I'm in my seventh term in the Minnesota House, and I am a progressive. I'm a bold progressive. I've always run and served as a bold progressive. I'm the only one of the six candidates who supported Bernie Sanders because I thought his platform addressed what's going on in our economy, which is the tremendous concentration of wealth and power in a few hands. And I'm a person who will actually stand up for ordinary people and make government level the playing field for them instead of for the wealthy and powerful.
Okay. Aaron Murphy, what about you?
You know, I am a registered nurse and a teacher. I'm a mom and a state legislator, and I'm running for governor. And I'm running for governor because I believe in a kind of politics that improves people's lives. And when we use that together, we can build a bright future for the people of Minnesota. I chose nursing because I care a lot about people, and I'm in politics for the very same reason. And I've spent the last 11 years with the people of Minnesota learning about us, about what makes us tick. And that's the best preparation to do this job. I have a lot of faith in us and our capacity to tackle the toughest issues in front of us. I'd like to do that.
Thank you. And Rebecca Otto.
I'm the most progressive and most viable candidate. I have a pathway to get to single-payer health care, tackle climate change in a meaningful way, and produce a quarter million good-paying jobs, provide 2 years tuition-free in our Minnesota state system so we have the workforce of the 21st century. We should be raising the wage so that work pays up to $15 an hour, and Minnesotans have voted for me statewide three times.
All right. Paul Thiessen.
Well, I think we've lost the art of governing in this state, in this country, and I think we need to elect a governor who believes in governing, not just in running campaigns, but actually governing. And I think the only measure of success in politics is actually getting stuff done. I think we have to focus in on economic security for Minnesota families, and we have to move Minnesota from the second most unequal state to the most equal state in the nation. And there's nobody in the race, I believe, that has the record of actually delivering on progressive agenda that I do.
Tim Walz.
Well, I'm a public school teacher from Mankato, a football coach, a veteran of the Minnesota National Guard, and for the past 12 years, I've been a proven leader in the United States Congress on issues from agriculture and conservation to education and veterans. I believe deeply in the people of this state, and I believe I'm a person who can not only win and deliver elections in all parts of the state, but govern afterwards.
All right, thanks. Thanks for keeping that brief, too. I appreciate that. But let's go back the other way now, and let me ask you the question, what's the biggest problem you believe is facing the state right now, and what would you do to fix it? Tim Walz, go ahead.
I think, first of all, and I would agree with Paul on this, that the art of governing, the ability to be able to self-govern and bring people together to solve these problems. We have issues facing us, whether it is opportunity gaps of children of color or whether it's a transportation system that served us well for years and not there. I think it's this ability to be able to find common ground with our neighbors to solve those problems. So if we're going to tackle an issue that I hear so much about health care, we have to bring people together on that common goal that it's a basic human right to get health care. How can we best deliver it? Making sure people can buy into Minnesota Care. But I think none of these things are possible unless you have the ability, first of all, to reach people across all political spectrums, and then find real solutions that make a difference in their lives.
Okay. Paul Thiessen, what do you think? Biggest problem facing the state, how would you fix it?
Well, we're the second most unequal state in the country on racial terms and many other terms as well, poverty, and we have problems with gender equality as well. But closing that racial opportunity gap would be the number one focus, I think, that we need to have over the next decade as Minnesotans. And, you know, the way we need to do it, root out institutional racism, but also be intentional about addressing the unintended consequences of policies we adopt. And I have a proposal to do an analysis of every bill that comes across my desk that says, is this going to widen or shrink the gaps between the races in our state? And I think if we do that, we're actually going to make the kind of progress we need to make.
Rebecca Otto.
Healthcare security is one of the biggest. Our current cost trajectory is not sustainable for healthcare, and it's impacting the federal government, state government, local governments, families, businesses, and it impacts our ability to grow our own in terms of businesses. So I have a plan, the Healthy Minnesota Plan, that will actually tackle this, get us to a single-payer healthcare system where everybody's covered, which would be, and we can reduce costs by 15% and increase health outcomes. And some basic pieces that I've been told over and over is people want to make sure that we have mental health services for our fellow Minnesotans when they need them. That'd be part of the standard benefit set, as well as substance abuse treatment. And innovation, by getting to a single-payer healthcare system, we will unleash the innovators and attract the innovators to our state, which is really important. And getting to the cutting edge of the clean energy economy is a great economic opportunity for our fellow Minnesotans.
Okay. Aaron Murphy, what do you think the biggest problem is that Minnesota is facing right now?
You know, Minnesota's politics have for years and years worked for the people of Minnesota. It has been the tool that we've been able to use to build our future. And it has, in the last number of years, moved more in the direction of Washington, D.C., and a kind of winner-take-all politics. And I know that if we are not able to center ourselves in a kind of politics that puts us in the center of it again, we're not going to be able to build the future, literally build our future here in the state of Minnesota. We won't be able to move forward with a healthcare solution that provides healthcare for everybody in the state of Minnesota. That's what I want to do, and it is top of mind for people all over the state. We won't build the infrastructure necessary to make sure that the communities across the state of Minnesota actually have what they need so they can build their own economies and build a future in those places. We have to put us back in our politics again so we can invest in education, in healthcare, in the jobs of our future, and tackle the toughest issues like racial disparities. Our okay. politics are in center of that.
Tina Liebling, what about you? What's the biggest problem? What would you do about it?
So we've seen this tremendous concentration of wealth and power in our nation, and it's great to talk about bringing people together and having a different kind of politics. But the reality is that there is a class of billionaires who want it all and are taking more and more. And the problem in the state is that lots and lots of families are struggling economically. They can't get ahead. They don't know how they're going to send their kids to college. They don't know how they're going to get the health care, pay for the health care that they need, even if they have insurance. So, and we need to protect our environment. So I want a focus on ordinary people. We need a governor who will actually stand up to those forces, who has the backbone to be for ordinary people when there are lots of lobbyists at the Capitol wanting their stuff. And that's what I'm in the race for, because we need a vision for ordinary people, and we need to fight for that vision before we compromise. Compromise is always going to be necessary in politics, but we should lay out a vision and fight for it for the ordinary working folks of this state before we compromise.
Chris Coleman.
Well, you know, as mayor for the last 12 years, you realize there isn't just one problem to solve. There are multiple things that you face on a daily basis, and the governor will face that as well. It is all of the things that my colleagues have said here. But the fact of the matter is, unless we address the fiscal instability going into the future, there's a real fiscal cliff that the state of Minnesota is facing. All of these issues that we want to tackle, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's transportation, whether it's investment in our infrastructure, our healthcare system, we won't be able to address that unless we get to fiscal stability. We need to roll back the tax cuts to the millionaires and billionaires in the largest corporations in the state of Minnesota that were passed last year. If we don't get our house in order, our financial house in order, we're not going to be able to tackle these long-term challenges that our state faces.
Okay, well, let's continue along those lines in terms of the economy and the state taxes and start with Rebecca Otto. And let me ask you, what kind of financial shape do you think the state is generally in? And has Governor Dayton done a good job with his stewardship of the state?
Well, you know, Governor Dayton was the state auditor, and it's really important training to be the governor. Arne Carlson was as well. And so understanding a sustainable budget and long-term financial planning. And so he came in where there had been rolling deficits for a decade, and not only did he fix that, he actually got us on the right footing. The problem is last session there was a bad tax bill, and so he wants to work to adjust that this next session. With the Fed's funding CHIP, that helps. And so I don't know what the new numbers are at this very moment, but we always have to keep our eye on the budget. And that's why I'm going after healthcare with my single-payer healthcare system. If we can reduce healthcare costs up to 15%, imagine what that does for our schools, our state, our cities, our counties. So that's what I'm doing, is making sure we have a strong economy so we can invest in those things we hold dear, but also that we get at the real issues, which is inequities in the system and costs.
Paul Thiessen, what about you in terms of the state's finances and the job Governor Dayton did, stewarding them?
Well, I think Governor Dayton did a very good job stewarding it, and I worked with him for 6 years to make that happen. One of the things I think I bring to this race is the fact that I've been in the trenches working on these issues as much or probably more so than anybody in the field right now. One of the proudest things I did when I came in as speaker and we had a multi-billion dollar budget deficit. We had borrowed billions of dollars from our schools. We had no budget reserve at all. And 2 years later, what did we have? We had a budget surplus that lasted for several years until this last tax bill. We paid off the schools, the money that had been borrowed from the schools, and we built up a couple billion dollar budget reserve. That budget reserve that we built up because of policy choices we made is the thing that's going to save us as we look at this deficit, this cliff that is coming. We do need to roll back that tax cut. No tax bill from the Republicans passed in the 6 years I was leader of the Democrats in the House. We made sure that happened. But not only did we balance the budget, we invested in all-day kindergarten. We invested for the first time in early child education in a meaningful way. We froze college tuitions. We gave provided health care to hundreds of thousands of more Minnesotans. So you can do this if you're willing to make the tough votes. But okay, you have to have leadership in there that understands the budget and is willing to bring people together to get those tough votes passed.
Okay. Tim Walz, what about you? What would you do on the state budget? What kind of shape do you think it's in?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think Governor Dayton has done a fine job. He was very clear about he was going to be fiscally responsible. He was going to pay for those things. And he made the case that I think all of us know, is that budgets are more than just fiscal documents. They're a moral reflection of what we value in this state. And I think in this last legislative session, when you saw $100 million going to premium cigars, that is an opportunity lost elsewhere. I think the state needs to be realistic. There are some projections. The sunset of the provider tax on health care is going to make it challenging as we move forward, and trying to harmonize the state with the GOP's tax bill that is going to have long-term damage. But I think more importantly, the job of the governor is always to go out there and make the case to the people of Minnesota of what's going to improve their lives, what's going to improve their communities. Expanding Highway 14 to a four-lane improves safety, improves commerce, and make the case that those tax dollars, and have the courage to ask people if you're going to pay for this. And I think that's the thing that has been lacking. And it can happen because the people of Minnesota understand that there's these moral responsibilities, investing in their children, investing in roads, investing in research, is the best way to keep the quality of life that we have.
Chris Coleman.
Well, at the end of the day, it's about honesty and transparency and what government costs. People want good roads. They want good schools. They want a health care system that works for all families, and they want all of these things. But the Republicans keep on telling us that somehow we can do this without actually, raising the revenue that we need. And with these tax cuts that are coming and the fiscal instability that we have, we have to address that. And I would also say that it's about communities across the state of Minnesota. When Tim Pawlenty cut local government aid, it forced property taxes up across the state of Minnesota and in every corner of the state, in large cities and small. And so one of the things that we need to do to fiscal to fix the fiscal situation in Minnesota as a whole is to restore local government aid so that cities can put police officers on the street and firefighters in the firehouses.
Tina Liebling.
Well, the question was about Governor Dayton and what he did. And, of course, Governor Dayton's done many wonderful things. But more recently, I think he's made some really critical mistakes, in part because he really wasn't willing or able to stand up to some of the forces in the governor's office. And this is one of the reasons I'm running. You have to be able to stand up because you can have the greatest values in the world, but if you roll over when the pressure's on, it doesn't help. So the tax bill, he never should have signed it in the first place. He's done a couple of other things that have put us kind of on a bad trajectory with our budget. One is signing a waiver that came from the federal government to, this is around the insurance companies, a subsidy for insurance companies, which I think he never should have accepted that. We shouldn't be subsidizing insurance companies. We should be helping people get health insurance that they need. He also signed a Health and Human Services bill that's putting us on a very bad trajectory. We're losing some revenue that was coming in to support some of our public programs. I think we need to stop giving deals to corporations and focus on our small businesses in this state and help them, because that's what really boosts our economy. That's what really gives people opportunity.
Okay. Aaron Murphy, state of the state fiscally, and how did the governor do?
Mike, when I was a kid, my job was to go to the grocery store with my mom. And as she put things in the cart, I had to add up what they cost to make sure that when we got to the register that we had enough money, because she didn't use a credit card and just had cash. Our job is to balance the budget in Minnesota, constitutionally obligated, unlike Washington, D.C., who continues to play games with that budget. When Governor Pawlenty was in office, he played a lot of games as well, and it created a lot of instability for the state's budget and for Minnesota families. So my commitment to balancing our budget is rock solid. We need to have reserves available when we face, and we will again face, economic downturns so that Minnesota's communities don't pay a price for that. Governor Dayton, when I was the majority leader, we did raise some taxes, but we put the budget in structural balance, and that has been critical for our ability to look ahead, to begin to do some of the planning that has been waiting for that budget stability. And if we want to build a future that includes everybody in the state of Minnesota, it is built on a balanced budget, and that is a commitment that I will make to the people of Minnesota.
That's Aaron Murphy. She's one of the DFL candidates running for governor. Caucus night is tomorrow, your first chance to weigh in on it if you show up at your caucus. Also joined by five other candidates, Tina Liebling, Chris Coleman, Rebecca Otto, Paul Thiessen, and Tim Walz, talking about some of the issues that the next governor will have to face. And, you know, I want to ask you, we'll stay with you, Representative Murphy. After all the hoopla and the excitement of the Super Bowl in Minneapolis last night and the week or two leading up to it, was it worth it for the taxpayers to invest that much money in the Viking Stadium? And if an opportunity or a challenge like that came up again, would you do it?
So I was I voted no on that Viking Stadium, and I gave it a lot of consideration. The district that I represent, that's not too far from here, felt very divided about that issue. And I wanted to make sure that I was looking out for St. Paul's interests, but I also wanted to make sure I was looking out for the interests of the people of Minnesota. And at the end of the day, I believe that the funds that were used for that Viking Stadium and the obligation of the people of Minneapolis were too high a price to pay when considering the other things that were waiting for attention in the state of Minnesota. I know that Minnesota shone last night across this nation, and that was a beautiful thing. And I understand and appreciate what the Vikings do for the people of Minnesota, for our sense of place, and I love that. I do. But every time we make a choice about where we spend our resources, we have to take that in consideration along with the needs of the people all over the state of Minnesota. And when I think of the things that I have seen and done over the last 11 years, there are communities that are still waiting for things like broadband and affordable child care and affordable and accessible health care. And those human needs, for me, come first, and they always will as the state's governor.
I've kind of lost track of the order I was going in, but let's let Representative Liebling answer that question.
Well, the Viking Stadium, I voted no on it. In fact, I voted no on all of the stadium deals. I'm not against building stuff at all, but I think that when we make public investments, when we invest public dollars, it has to be for the good of the public. And too often, it's about how many lobbyists people have at the Capitol and who they're giving money to behind the scenes. And there were a lot of lobbyists going around the Capitol when that passed. I thought that it was not a good deal for the public, and so I was against it. I don't think Ziggy Wilf needed our help, at least not to that degree. And we'll see. I mean, it's always great to have big events, and that's all wonderful. The hoopla is wonderful, but at the end of the day, I don't think the small businesses benefited. In fact, I heard from some small business owners that were very upset, and people whose lives were disrupted for this big hoopla event. Time will show whether the actual financial benefits came as they were hyped, but you know, from what I'm reading, there's a lot of skepticism about that, and I'll be looking at it to see what happened.
Okay. Chris Coleman, how do you look at the Viking Stadium specifically and some of these other big projects that our taxpayers help fund?
Well, I think we could have gotten a better deal on the Viking Stadium. I don't think that you know, to me is, you know, something that we should have fought for, paying $500 million, half the cost of the stadium, when the profit is going directly into the Wilf's pocket, just the value of the increase in the value of the team alone. You know, are we sharing in that? I don't think that we have a piece of that. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at what we did in St. Paul with the soccer stadium for Minnesota United, that is a $200 million privately financed stadium. Yes, we're putting infrastructure and we're putting some of the public realm in place, but it's a small fraction of the overall cost of the stadium. The fact of the matter is, what do you, you know, the Vikings and the NFL are an important part of Minnesota, as are the Twins, as are the Minnesota Wild. So while we could have gotten a better deal, I think that to say that we should have just let them go off somewhere else, which is what they would have done, I think would have really hurt our state in the long run. Not only would we not have had the exposure that we had last night, but this is about companies making decisions about where they're going to locate, about millennials making decisions about where they're going to locate, and they want those quality amenities that the state of Minnesota has.
Tim Walls, what do you think about this?
Yeah, we all get to Monday morning quarterback on this one, I guess, so it's appropriate. But I do think my colleagues, and I think Chris is probably hitting on that, that one of the things is that we have to talk about priorities. We have to talk about what builds great cities, what builds great states. I think the frustration people have is if you're sitting out there in Cleveland, Minnesota, and you're holding bonding referendums to fix the roof of your school, and you see state money going to a private business, those are things that that cause angst. I think, once again, it's about more about communication. I think we need to see where the numbers are. I think it certainly adds to our quality of life. The NFL is a big business, but I too share concerns about this, that if we're over incentivizing, the way we draw people here and the way we make this a great place is we have the best qualified workforce, we have the healthiest population, we have the safest cities. We do those kind of things that naturally draw people there, and instead of just always incentivizing. But I don't want to be disingenuous. Tax increment financing on different businesses, whether it's a grocery store in North Mankato or not, is something that we use. But it is about prioritizing. It is about making sure that the people of Minnesota as a whole are well served.
Paul Thiessen, you're from Minneapolis. What do you think?
Well, I'm not going to Monday morning quarterback because I was in the middle of the debate and voted for the bill and helped make sure that the stadium got done. And I won't shy away from that fact. I think the Super Bowl last night was great for the city of Minneapolis. And I think that there's dividends that not just benefit folks that were in business and made money as part of the Super Bowl, but the exposure that that gave to the state of Minnesota, and as others have mentioned, the attraction that people have to this city as being a world city. That's where we need to be if we're going to compete. We can't just compete against Des Moines, Iowa, and Omaha, Nebraska. We need to compete against Seattle. We need to compete against Beijing. And if we don't, if we aren't willing to make the kind of investments that make that happen, then that's the case. It is, and I think Tim is right. It is easy for people to kind of Monday morning quarterback and talk about other priorities, but when you're the governor, you actually have to step up and make tough decisions. I think it was the right decision, and I think last night showed it was.
Rebecca Otto.
Yes. Well, I would contend that competition comes from having an educated workforce and investing in those things that government really is supposed to be investing in. And having chaired an operating levy referendum for the Forest Lake schools years ago, and we're in a property poor district, meaning we don't have that business tax base, it is so hard for that district with bond referendums as well, just to maintain facilities, keep teachers in the classroom. And so taxpayers want us to make sure we're focusing on what's required. That's in our constitution. So I would say that our resources should be going to our school buildings, to our roads, to our bridges. When we have that choice, And the NFL is deeply wealthy. And it remains to be seen what all of this means at this point, because Minneapolis had to, you know, the city council took a vote. It was a local vote. There was a legislative vote and a governor, you know, signing of a bill. But in terms of costs, the cost-benefit analysis, I don't know that we know that it's a positive for us. Generally, stadiums, people only have so much to spend in entertainment dollars, and it just gets shifted. So if I had been there at the legislature because you asked us, you know, I would not have supported it.
Okay. And I just need to say one more thing, if that's all right. I mean, everybody's talking about priorities, and that's great, but I think it's important that we also come back and look at people's records. So if you want to talk about investing in education, when I was Speaker of the House, we made the biggest investment in education in the history of our state. We invested the biggest amount, $250 million in higher education when I was Speaker of the House. We started early childhood education in a meaningful way here. We covered about a couple hundred thousand more Minnesotans because of investments we made in healthcare. We actually closed the gap between big school districts and smaller school districts in terms of the funding they had so that they could actually make the kind of investments that other people had. And, you know, we did. So if we're going to talk about priorities, I mean, everybody likes to play this either-or game in Monday morning quarterback, but I think if you're the governor, you have to step up and defend your priorities, but make the tough decisions. And I think this is a great place for us to think about and for the people of Minnesota to think about who in this race is actually not just going to be willing to kind of talk about every side of the issue, but who's actually going to have a record to step up and say, we did this. And there are a couple of us here that have done that. But I think that that's an important thing for Minnesotans to consider as they go to the precinct caucuses.
Okay. Now you really broke the order, which is okay. If anybody else wants to weigh in, let me know. Or if not, I'll move on to a new question. And that is, we've been talking about investment or spending money to help a big business. What about the state minimum wage? What level should the minimum wage be at? And then to let me know if you're walking the walk, what are you paying your campaign staff, and are they getting benefits? And Rebecca Otto, let's start with you and go back around this way.
Well, I will tell you that I put out a plan to raise the wage to $15 an hour gradually over 5 years. And I think it's really important because in Minnesota, we actually value work. And if you're willing to work 40 hours a week, you should be able to come close to supporting yourself. That is not a living wage. But we have to start somewhere. And I had an editor ask me, is that enough, Rebecca? And I said, the legislature can certainly talk about more, but we know that the gradual increase is very important. So we need to have the discussion. There's too many parents that are working 3 and 4 jobs that I met who are not able to be home with their children at homework time. They're not able to be home with them at mealtime. We know research-wise that children do better in school and have better educational outcomes when parents can sit down for a meal with them. So that's why I actually put this out there. I have a plan, and I did it early.
Mm-hmm. What about your own staff? Are you paying them $15 an hour or more and benefits?
I will tell you, to be honest, I don't know because I don't pay them. That's the staff, but I can certainly check on that.
Okay. Well, let's go back around this way. Paul Thiessen, minimum wage, and are your own workers getting at least that?
Our campaign staff is getting that, and they are getting benefits, healthcare benefits and other benefits as well. So, yes, I think that is a thank you for asking that question because it's an important one. So I was Speaker of the House again when we raised the minimum wage in 2014. It was actually a tough lift even then, frankly, and we were all Democrats. So this is a difficult discussion to have. And I think that that's important because it shows that even these issues that seem so obvious, you need to actually have the political experience. You need to have the toughness to actually push it through. And that's what we did. I support $15 perhaps more as a minimum wage in the state. I met a woman not too long ago who works at Taco Bell here in St. Paul, lives over in actually across the river. She's 20 years old, has an 18-month-old son. She has childcare instability. She has uncertain transportation. That's the people that we're talking about. And she gets paid barely over minimum wage. We're not going to solve the problems we need in this state unless we do raise the minimum wage. But we got to do more than that. We need strong unions in this state so that we're raising everybody's wages. And when we have strong unions, everybody's wages go up. So I believe in that. I believe in raising the minimum wage. But we also need to help people on the other side, the money coming out of their pockets, childcare costs, the cost of college education, retirement security. Unless we're dealing with that whole package, we are not going to solve the problem that Tina identified, which is this concentration of wealth and power in this country.
Okay.
We need to lift up everybody else.
Let's move on to Tim Walz.
Yes, I pay my staff above minimum wage to a living wage, and I pay everyone on my staff health care, and I have the largest campaign. I also, the first vote I took in Congress was to raise the federal minimum wage, and I took a pledge at that time in 2007 to not accept any money and send it directly back to the Treasury until we got a living wage for people, and I've sent back about $100,000. Again, not a look at me or whatever. It's about modeling. It's about showing that we can do that. In the state of Minnesota, I think we know we need to raise that living wage, and that's going to include working with employers to make sure that this works on both sides. This is not an issue of a wishy-washy compromise type of thing. It's a reality that the people who pay the wages need to be there of making that, and that I believe that Minnesota's employers want to make sure everyone has a living wage, and we can fight for that. When you've got a governor who stands up, lives by that, says it, states it out there, and then trying to get there, that's what we have to do. And I would agree that Paul is on a good, made a good point on this. The ability to collectively bargain and organize your workplace is one of the strongest indicators and one of the best correlations to where we're going to get a real living wage, and we should encourage that.
All right, Chris Coleman.
To start off, my staff does get paid over $15 an hour. They get benefits, with one notable exception, me. my wife is calling this my unpaid internship for the next year. But this is a question about economic security for all Minnesota families. In many ways, the private sector is setting the bar already. Target just announced that they're going to go to $15. If you went down to Pearson's Candy Factory on West 7th Street, you'd start at $13.50 an hour with benefits, health care, with a retirement plan and all of those things. But the fact of the matter is the wealth inequality in this country is going to destroy us. And since the 1970s, the average CEO salary has gone up 1,000%, and the average worker's has gone up 10 or 15%. The average CEO makes 300 times what the average worker is. So at the end of the day, this isn't just about $15 an hour minimum wage, because that doesn't help families survive. That's just a basic floor. But this is a question about economic security and true wages that actually provide economic security for families.
Tina Liebling.
The state of Minnesota puts out a lot of data on the cost of living, and I've been talking about this a lot on the campaign trail. Right now in the metro area, to have a living wage, you need about $19 an hour. So we need to really examine this. I think we should absolutely fight to raise the minimum wage all over the state, because people who are working have to be able to earn enough just to have a basic standard of living. And about half of Minnesotans are really not doing very well in this state. So we have a serious problem. We find plenty of money to support corporations. We were just talking about the Viking Stadium. There's an example. We find plenty of money to offer to Amazon when it wants to come and build a headquarters here, and lots of other things, even a property tax break for soccer stadium. You know, that's always there. But when it comes to helping our small businesses, we don't do it. I think we should raise the minimum wage. We should fight to raise it to an actual living wage, even if that's different in different parts of the state, and figure out a way to help our small businesses actually pay that, and not in 5 years. We should fight to do that now, ASAP, because families are struggling. And if we don't do that, government is asked to pay for it in other ways. Employers want us to build workforce housing. Well, what does that mean? It's housing people can afford on the very low wages those employers are paying. That is wrong. People shouldn't have to go to government for a handout.
And what about your own campaign? Are you paying?
I have a very small campaign, a very small campaign budget, because I'm funded by people who are giving me $27 and $5 and $10. So the very slim staff that we have, we're paying them as well as we possibly can. I would love to get to a point where I could actually have full-time people with full benefits. That would be my ideal. Okay. And if people want to help me get there, I would love that.
Okay. Erin Murphy.
To your specific question, there's a organization, Loop, organizing professionals that work in politics, and they have set a standard for pay that we should hit, and we are in my campaign, and we are, of course, covering their benefits. That's important to me. It's a value statement. I grew up in a great big family, and every year when the school year started, the thing my mom sweat the most was, would she have enough money to buy us the shoes we needed for our gym classes? And they were expensive at the time, and it made her worry. And I want to make sure that Minnesotans have the money in their pocket to be able to buy their kids their shoes. But we also know that when Minnesotans have money in their pocket, it increases economic activity and our economy expands. When Paul was the Speaker of the House, I was the Majority Leader. And a lot of what we did made sure that Minnesotans had a real fair shake in this economy. We did raise the minimum wage, and I think we need to do it again. And as we see organizations like the Chamber of Commerce coming to the Capitol and trying to preempt local units of government from taking that issue up, our response to that should be, let's take up the minimum wage at the state level and answer this question. Let's look at earned, safe, and sick time. Let's take on health care and make sure it's affordable for people. And the same thing with child care and higher education costs. So Minnesota families have the ability to live the life of their choosing based on what they're earning in work.
Okay. Let me change the subject. I guess we're still on economic development. A lot of debate about copper nickel mining in northeastern Minnesota. Would you allow those projects to go forward? Would you encourage those projects to go forward? And let's start back at the beginning with Chris Coleman.
Well, first of all, you know, we're a natural resource-based economy in the state of Minnesota. That includes farming, that includes timber, that includes mining. We've been mining safely in northern Minnesota for hundreds of years, or 100 years plus. Copper nickel mining is different, but it's gone through the PolyMet project has gone through a very rigorous environmental review through the Obama administration. We're getting close to the kind of final determinants of what that project would have to do to move forward, including a $1 billion bond on behalf of the company in order to make sure that we're dealing with any future cost of cleanup. But we need to be willing to ask the question, if we're not going to mine up in northern Minnesota, how are we going to get to a carbon neutral economy? There are 5 tons of copper in every windmill. There are up to 200 pounds of copper in every hybrid vehicle. If you have a Tesla battery, you have nickel and magnesium and all the minerals that we see. And are we going to get them in a place where we have the highest environmental standards? Are we going to get those minerals where we have high labor standards? Or are we going to get it from a third world country where we can turn a blind eye to environmental quality and labor standards? I'd like to prove to the rest of the world how we can do this correctly, how we can do it right. We have to protect the boundary waters. We have to protect Lake Superior. As governor, I will do that. But we need to move forward on this question.
Tina Liebling.
I'm firmly opposed to doing this in Minnesota. It's never been done safely in a water-rich environment. The proposal, the more I learn about it, the more frightened I become about what this can mean for our future. There's plenty of copper available on the world market in the United States, too. We don't have to put our boundary waters at risk. We don't have to put Lake Superior and the whole Duluth watershed at risk to do this. This is one of the most toxic industries there is, and we would be turning over our natural resources to these corporations who have really no interest in us and really don't care about the jobs. They're about their bottom lines.
Okay.
The bond, if you look at it carefully, it doesn't really work because it's just not really the right kind of guarantee, and there's no guarantee that any amount of money could even clean this up if we had the kind of disaster they've had in Canada.
Okay, Aaron Murphy.
As the state's governor, it's going to be my job to protect the strategic asset of water for the state of Minnesota, and I want Minnesotans to understand that first and foremost. It is important that we follow the law and use science to guide and allow us to do what we need to do to protect our water. And when I think about the things that threaten our water, copper nickel mining is one of those potentials, but so is the way that we farm, so is development, especially when you think about White Bear Lake. And so is the way that we salt our highways and our freeways. It's my job to protect our water. It's also my job to protect our future and our jobs. Those things come together, and when we pit them against one another, something is going to go away in a way that we don't want it to. So as the state's governor, I will follow the law. And if a company follows that permitting process as PolyMet has and they receive a permit, they should be allowed to proceed. And if they don't, then they can't.
Okay. Rebecca Otto.
Well, serving as state auditor now for almost 12 years, I'm on the executive council where we actually vote on natural resource leases, including mining, so ferrous and non-ferrous. Copper nickel is non-ferrous. We've done ferrous mining for over 100 years in Minnesota fairly successfully. The non-ferrous we've never done, and we need to be very careful and cautious moving forward. All the good government studies show that government never gets enough in terms of a damaged deposit, and the taxpayers end up holding the bag, and we do not have the resources to be saddled with financial liability in the future from this type of mining. PolyMet was the first real illustration of the problems with this type of mining. They have over 500 years required for cleanup. And so science aside, PolyMet's not offering enough to keep us whole financially. And this is where we get into trouble. Governors say jobs, jobs, jobs. But at the end of the day, the ramifications of something going wrong in one of these mines is much bigger than the small number of jobs we're going to get. And frankly, the mining industry just said they're going to go further to robotics. They have driverless trucks now for the mines. And our deposit for the copper nickel is very dispersed. So it's a different type of mining. And so we must, government is the only one that is going to protect our place and our people and our workers. And finally, with PolyMet, they have not agreed to use union miners in that mine. And if they don't, it's going to drive wages down for our fellow Minnesotans on the Iron Range, and that is not what they need right now.
Okay. Paul Thiessen, where are you on this copper nickel mining issue?
Well, we claim to be the party of science as Democrats. We claim to be the party of the rule of law. And so it seems to me if the science is followed and the permit is issued by the experts and if the process is followed, and there's too many people trying to disrupt that process right now, but if that process is followed and the permit is issued, it is not the place of the governor to step in and reverse that. And so I would not do that. If it's not issued, of course, the project doesn't go forward. Probably what's more important right now, though, is that we need a governor, once that permit is issued, if it is issued, that is going to be willing to enforce its terms. And we have not done very well historically on that front. Our agencies have not always enforced permits. And so it seems to me the biggest thing that the next governor has on his or her plate is to make sure that the terms of that permit are honored. And if they're not, that we step in and take the steps that need to be taken to get it back on track or stop it from going forward. I just want to say two other things. One is, I also think as Democrats, we tend to talk about certain kind of jobs as lesser kind of jobs than other kind of jobs. And I think we tend sometimes to look down or speak down about jobs where people are actually working with their hands. And I think that that gets us in a lot of trouble. But more importantly, it's simply wrong. And we need to be better about making sure that we respect the dignity of work that everybody does. Okay. And the last thing I think that is really important on this is we don't live in a risk-free world. And anybody that believes we live in a risk-free world or can live in a world where nothing bad is going to happen, they don't have the realistic view of what the real world is like to be the governor of the state of Minnesota.
Tim Walz.
Well, I'd like to thank Paul. His statement on workers is exactly right, the nobleness of this. These are not just how people pay their mortgage. It's how they see the world. I think one of the things as your governor you would see is not having to guess how someone would act on this. I represent one of the largest agricultural districts in the country. The ability to produce food, fuel, and fiber for the world and is something we are incredibly proud of. It's an economic driver. But I'm proud I've had the support of agricultural groups as well as environmental groups. When it comes to mining, we do have to follow the science. I have voted for some of these projects in the past. I have voted against them, depending on where the EIS and the statements come out. There's no doubt about it. If you had the Republican candidates up here, they'll all tell you they'll support mining. They won't support the miners, but they'll support mining. They also won't support that idea that you have to do this in a responsible manner. I think it's true. Copper nickel mining has risks. I think it's true, too, that it hasn't been done the way it needs to be done. But I believe in Minnesota. I believe in science. I've sat through enough courses up at UMD up there to feel like I can audit a degree, and that's the way it should be. So as your governor, my pledge is to follow that science of where it goes, to make sure that those things are put in place, to honor the workers that do that, and to understand where Chris articulated clearly on this. These are metals that move us to a clean energy economy, moving off fossil fuels, and we as Minnesotans should attempt and see if it's possible for us to lead in that way, and I think we can.
And Mike, just
yes.
One last thing.
Erin Murphy.
I think it's important that we do more to invest in the research and science that will help deliver solutions for us going forward. And there is great work happening at the Natural Resources and Research Institute at the University of Minnesota in Duluth when it comes to things like water and water protection, as well as the University of Minnesota when we think about farm practices, winter perennials, cover crops that could go to market. Our future in part rests in the discoveries that will come from that hard work, and we should invest in that.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. This issue of the racial achievement gap has come up, but there are other racial problems in the state, and we've seen some of them over the course of the past week with some Facebook posts and such, and I'm just wondering, how do you talk to people who think Muslims are a threat? How do you get your message across? How do you bridge that divide that is often, tainted by bias and bigotry? And Tim Walz, I wonder if you could start with that.
Yeah, first of all, and I know as a teacher, like so many of us, the fear of the unknown is powerful in people. The fear of change gets there. I think one of the things that you bridge this gap by making sure that people see neighbors as neighbors. This constitutional right of no religious test, this idea that we are a country of immigrants, is something that we've all championed. But I think more than anything, in a world where they see the chaos, they see things, and they see a very concerted effort to demonize certain groups of people, I think it's more important than ever at that time to reassure people that the systems that we have in place are working, that are their neighbors are there just like them, and to celebrate that diversity. I'm a global studies teacher. I've worked in Tibet and lived in these places to try and understand. Bring that joy of the world to people. Bring that understanding of what makes our community strong, and relieve that fear of the unknown, letting them trust and know that the systems are safe. People, and that's why I've advocated for years comprehensive immigration reform that assures people that these things are working. We know that these programs work. We know that resettling refugees is beneficial for Minnesota, but we need to take that message to all corners of Minnesota where maybe they hadn't been exposed. They hadn't seen it. And I think the governor's job is to not try and, first of all, find out what's wrong with these people that they're not as welcoming, but to understand that they are. There's a natural cautiousness, but there's a goodness in Minnesotans. And I believe it's as much education, it's as much tolerance on both sides as anything, and then recognizing we're stronger with that diversity.
Okay. Paul Thiessen.
Yeah, well, after the last election, my son, who was in eighth grade at the time, came back from school the day after the election, and they have a number of Muslims in their school. And he said, people, you know, were crying, they're afraid. And he said, what do I do? And I, you know, being a good parent, I suppose, I asked him the question right back, what do you think you ought to do? And he said, well, the only thing I can do is make my school as welcoming as I possibly can and take steps to do that. And I think that's a lesson for all of us. So the governor has to model on this issue, and we need to model through our state policy to make our state as welcoming as possible. I've worked in my job as a lawyer representing people seeking asylum from multiple continents across the world for several years. Hearing their stories and the persecution and difficulties that they're coming from because of their political beliefs, because of their religious beliefs, and coming to this country where they can feel some sense of safety, I think is critically, critically important. And I think, frankly, the way we talk about this is it's our patriotic duty not to undermine the values that we grew up with as a state and as a country. A patriotic duty that says when people come here, we should be welcoming. When people want to have freedom of religion, freedom from political persecution, freedom to speak their mind, freedom to make a basic life for themselves, what is America about if it's not that? And okay, if we can come around that fundamental patriotic American duty, I think that's the place that this conversation can be had in the best way. And people that are saying we don't want people here because of their religious beliefs. And maybe they're coming out of fear, but quite frankly, that's not patriotic and it's not American, and we shouldn't stand for it.
Running low on time, so we got to keep moving. Rebecca Otto.
Briefly, you know, as governor, your job is to be there for all Minnesotans, and you don't allow others to take that cynical position of trying to divide people by religion. And our current president's done a lot to try to create fear around our fellow Minnesotans who happen to be Muslim. And so as governor, I would never engage in that. I know so many people and have so many friends in the community. We're all Minnesotans. We're united by our common humanity. We all have hopes and dreams for our children. Everyone wants to live the American dream. And so as governor, I would never engage in that type of behavior and or encourage it because, you know, there are many Minnesotans who, you know, we fear what we don't know. And so not having exposure to people of different religions, there may be issues. But in my administration, I'm going to have a diverse administration that will debunk some of the things that have been put out there.
Okay. Erin Murphy.
We know that it is easy to divide people with fear and hatred, and we are seeing that happen right now with candidate Jeff Johnson running for governor and some of my colleagues in the Minnesota House. And I think that is antithetical to who we are as Americans and the values on which this country was built. This is a country of religious freedom. It is a country that welcomes people, especially people who are fleeing terror or harm in other parts of the world. And I believe when we embrace that goodness in who we are, and I use that voice, that positive, possible voice of what we stand for as Americans and as Minnesotans, we can bring together the people who are coming to this country and coming to the state to build our future, to live in peace, and to build support for their own families. I will not ask for the people who have come to this country from other parts of the world to defend their faith and to defend their religion. I will recognize their faith and their rightful place in this country, and I will never take a safe political vote that contradicts my own personal values about this country and its welcoming place for people who are seeking a safe place to live.
Tina Liebling.
Well, I think we all pretty much agree on the basic issue. I'm not going to repeat a lot of what was said here, but I represent a district that I flipped it from red to blue, and it's still about 40% Republican. So I talk a lot with people who don't agree with me. And the way I explain this to people in my district and in other places where I speak to people is that we are a changing state. A lot more of our young people are people of color. They're much more diverse. We have workforce issues in the state. More of us are older, more of us retiring. This is about all of us. We need everyone together to actually make our economy run. So this is not about being nice people, although we are. This is about our self-interest as Minnesotans, that we have to come together around this. And there are hate mongers. I think most people are really good people in Minnesota, but there are hate mongers, and there are white supremacists, and there are Nazis, and we have to stand up to those people. We're not going to win them over. We have to understand when people can be spoken to, and they are good, fair-minded people, and when they're just hate mongers, and those people have to be called out for that.
Chris Coleman.
Well, this is an area where our records as candidates diverge. Before Donald Trump passed a Muslim ban, there was an important vote in Congress in 2015, and Tim Walz joined with the Republicans in Congress to ban Syrian refugees at a time of an incredible refugee crisis in that country, banning them from coming to this country. At the same time, I was fighting to make sure that St. Paul was a welcoming and safe city for all of our refugees and all of our immigrants. My grandmother came to this country from a war-torn Ireland. She came not because she wanted to be in Minnesota, but because it wasn't safe for her to be in Ireland. And before they didn't like Muslims, and before they didn't like Latinos, they didn't like Irish, they didn't like Catholics, they didn't like Italians, they didn't like Eastern Europeans. We are a country of immigrants. The state was built on our immigrant population. And to ever stand against that, it flies in the face of everything that has made this country and the state great.
Let's give Tim Walz a chance to respond.
Well, having not been there, mischaracterizing that, it was not. It was a vote to strengthen the system that I've supported and resettled folks on. That 80 Democrats in the
Tim,
House
you've
caucus.
Tim, you apologized for the 80, vote, so 80, it must have been what...
Can I finish?
Well, I'm just saying...
Can I finish, Chris?
Of course you can.
Can I please? My record seems to show, and to attack where my faith is at, what I apologize for was in the age of Trump prior to that, that the issue was is people didn't disagree that I'm trying to strengthen the system to folks to believe that their neighbors are coming in safely. What I said and I apologize for is at that time people said that bill wasn't going to go anywhere, and the Trump administration went further, and I said I apologize because people told me I know what you were trying to do, I just needed a friend at that point. And I said I agree, I'll stand there with you. But to question whether I was trying to get it right, the decision by 80 Democrats was to make sure that they didn't undermine the system, and it asked for a single signature.
Okay.
A single signature.
We're actually out of time. I wish we could go another hour. It's just getting good. But anyway, thank you so much for coming by. That's Tim Walz, Paul Thiessen, Rebecca Otto, Aaron Murphy, Tina Liebling, and Chris Coleman. Go out to caucus tomorrow night. I hope this helped you pick your favorite. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Mulcahy.